This is Your Working Life, a podcast that provides you with tools, inspiration, and resources so you can enjoy your career and love your life. I'm Caroline Dowd Higgins. I'm a speaker, an author, and an executive coach. And today, I am delighted to welcome Melissa Clark to the show. Melissa will discuss a topic near and dear to my heart, how individuals with a workaholism streak can recover, and how organizations and leaders can think about creating a company culture of well-being and productivity. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh. When this book arrived, I, kidding you not, did a little happy dance. It is such an important book. And you and I were chatting before the show started. I'm a recovering workaholic. And I say recovering because for me, it was a bit of a work addiction. And I know that you have experienced workaholism in your life as well. And your research is extraordinary, but I'd love to hear first, how did you first experience workaholism that perhaps impacted your career and the research that you do?
Yeah, I have always kind of struggled with going too far with everything from a young age. You know, always needed to be that overachiever who joins all the clubs, and that continued on through college. I took on a couple really demanding jobs. And when I, you know, became a graduate student, this is when I had both of my kids, was when I was in graduate school, which is basically a full-time job. You know, you work many, many hours. And one of the things that really kind of shook me, and I had to reflect back later and just realize how ridiculous it was I tell this story in the book, that when I was about to have my daughter, I was trying to finish up a midterm exam, which was due like the next day or something. And I was at a coffee shop and I went into labor and I did not stop working on the midterm for a couple more hours while I was in labor. It just sounds ridiculous. But this was my mindset. Like, I just can't stop. I can't ask for extra time. I want to be a good graduate student, which basically translates into the workforce as I want to be a good employee. And so, you know, that really was striking to me. And I didn't really realize it in the moment, but reflecting back, that was really the start of feeling like I've taken it too far. And so trying to make some changes and really understand why it was that I was like this and what this thing called workaholism was, which led me to research that for years.
Thank you for sharing that story. And your daughter was born healthy and safely, so you got to the hospital. Yay. Yes. Oh, wow.
Yes.
And I'm nodding my head because everything that you said resonates, although not the going into labor. I have not had children. So cheers to you that you made it through. But my goodness, I can relate to that, because that overachiever syndrome is prevalent. So is workaholism a clinical condition? You know, you've done this extraordinary research, you've seen people in action, and we're going to dive really deeply into that. But it is something, is it diagnosable?
It is not. So it's not in the DSM, which is the formal manual that clinical psychologists use. However, people have called it kind of the socially acceptable addiction, sort of in jest. But if you think about how it impacts people's lives, workaholism does really impact people's lives in a very similar way to an addiction. It could be difficult to kind of curb these impulses to always work all the time. So it is similar to an addiction in many ways, but it is not a formal diagnosable condition, if you will.
You know what I find so fascinating, though? These are my words, but I think it's the only addiction that we celebrate. And there are many organizations that champion the working around the clock and burning the candles at both ends. And they see people like me coming thinking, we got a workhorse here, right? We can really get our dollar out of her. Was that your experience too, with your own scenario and all of the interviews that you did researching people?
Oh yeah, absolutely. What other addiction do people put on the wall? you know, hustle harder, work till you drop. It just is ridiculous when you think about it, but totally agree with you. It is absolutely celebrated here in the US, different places around the world. You know, some countries more so than others, but yeah, it's been ingrained in us, many of us, from a very young age. You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, this Protestant work ethic. You can achieve anything if you work hard enough. So it's no wonder that we celebrate this and have a hard time thinking that there's any other way to be a successful person.
So let's deconstruct it for this global audience. And again, you and I chatted about this before the show. So many of our listeners are women, or identify as women. And I think this is unique for women, not to say that men don't experience it, but I believe that you and I are in agreement that the journey for a workaholic woman is very different than a man. So let's start with deconstructing. There are four main components to workaholism that you write about. Mm-hmm. Would you share some detail about that, Melissa?
Absolutely. So when people think about workaholism, the most obvious is the behavioral component, where you're working longer than is necessary. You take work with you everywhere. That's kind of the more obvious aspect, but there are several other aspects of workaholism that are internal. You have a motivation to, or almost an urge to always be working. The technical term is called introjected motivation. That's what scholars call it, but really it's about driven to work because of feeling like you ought to be, like you should be. So this socially internalized belief that drives us to feel like we always should be working. Along with that is always thinking about work. So that's the cognitive component. We might wake up in the middle of the night thinking about something work-related, or we just can't shut it off in our minds. And also the emotional component. We oftentimes feel anxious or unsettled or guilty or frustrated when we are prevented from working or we can't work. And so it's multidimensional. It's not just about hours worked. It's actually correlated just moderately with actual hours worked. It's about all the other energy spent thinking about work and obsessing about work and feeling guilty when you're not working that are the all-consuming aspects that make workaholism what it is.
Well, I'm shaking my head in agreement because all of this I find incredibly relatable. And one of my challenges was not being able to turn off that work connection. I felt so tethered, that classic overachiever. So evenings and weekends, I couldn't turn it off. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't give myself permission to rest,
right?
Which became, for me, physically debilitating. Did you see a correlation there?
Right. Yeah, it's very difficult for workaholics to do other things and not feel guilty about it. So I love this example that someone told me in the interviews was working light. So for example, the woman I interviewed, she would at night, she would pull out her laptop and pour herself a glass of wine because her rationale was, well, it's not truly work because I'm also enjoying this glass of wine at the same time. For me, it's a problem with, for example, sitting and watching a TV show and not grabbing my laptop and putting it on my lap and answering a couple emails or just do minor little work-related things. That is working light. That basically is this inability to completely disengage, both physically and psychologically, from work. So it's definitely something that many individuals struggle with, not just workaholics, just because of technology, but it is definitely something that occurred over and over in the interviews.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. That thread sounds so logical. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's that ruminating, right? Mm-hmm. Never letting it go. Sometimes I call it the monkey chatter. Did you find that many workaholics can't turn it off, can't stop processing and ruminating and sometimes even festering over things?
Oh, absolutely. So many people that I spoke with told me stories of waking up in the middle of the night and having to actually get out of bed because they could not go back to sleep until they did whatever it was that they were ruminating about. Things like not being able to focus when you're with your family on vacation, kind of your thoughts always linger back to work-related things. And, you know, the rest and recovery literature is very clear that psychologically detaching from work is super important for our health and well-being, so that when we go back to work, we are re-energized, basically. And so it's preventing that psychological detachment.
Makes so much sense. You know, and often I'll say to my clients, we plug in our phones every night. We know we've got to recharge them. Why don't we offer the same to our bodies to say, okay, and maybe that's to unplug metaphorically, right? But to have that rest and that recovery time. So what you're saying really resonates. We'll be right back after a quick break. I'd like to tell you about a special offer. If you want to bring your podcast to life or up your podcast game, you can get up to 2 months of free podcasting service with Libsyn using my special code CDHWORK. The Libsyn team will get your podcast on Apple and Spotify and give you access to critical stats and all the support you need to sound your best and grow your show. Use my special code CDHWORK. Hiring the right speaker for your event is a tremendous responsibility. You need a speaker who will work within your budget and engage your audience. Whether you're looking to retain or grow top talent, create a healthy workplace culture, or prevent burnout in your organization, I can create customized content to help you recharge, reignite, or reinvent your career. Let's talk about how I can help you achieve your special event goals. Connect with me at caroline.higgins.com. Tell me a little bit more. Are there factors, Melissa, that have really led to the rise of workaholism in the world today?
Absolutely. I think one of the big factors, not surprisingly, is technology. We're constantly tethered to our work by our phones, by our laptops. We can take work anywhere around the world. People know that they can reach out to us and get quick responses, right? So we get used to that pattern of back and forth. And so technology is a big one. Also, I will say that during COVID, most knowledge workers, you know, for the most part, were working from home for that period of time. That boundary between work and home becomes blurred physically, right? And a lot of people are continuing to work remotely, which I love remote work. I'm a huge fan. But it's important to recognize that you don't physically go to the office anymore. And so you don't have that actual boundary that helps you transition from your work role to your family role and vice versa. And so with working from home and with this constant connectivity, really just blurring those boundaries, allowing us to kind of always have the temptation to work, that has exacerbated this constant connectivity and making it more difficult to detach, because this is just kind of our new world of work, right? We're not going back. This is the way it is. And so we're kind of all more connected.
So I want to be really clear with this global audience about how detrimental workaholism is with our health, our well-being, our mental focus. Can you share some of the associated dangers? Because I think a lot of people live with workaholism because they think, it's not so bad, or it'll get better when, and it is truly debilitating.
Yeah. So I did dozens of interviews with individuals, many of them affiliated with Workaholics Anonymous. So have suffered from workaholism for many, many years and were in the process of changing the way that they worked through working with this organization. And so every single person, I kid you not, that I talked to that struggled with workaholism at one point or multiple points throughout their career experienced health issues. Sometimes it was a heart attack or multiple heart attacks, high blood pressure, sleep issues, even a whole bunch of just miscellaneous issues, autoimmune diseases, cancer. And it's not a coincidence that individuals that never turn it off are experiencing health outcomes. And of course, it's hard to get an exact causation, right? So it is workaholism that caused this thing, but it's not a good thing, and it can exacerbate some biological risk factors that we have. And so it's not doing anything to help us, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. The research on why this affects us physically, one of the main things is that with workaholics, we are operating in constant fight or flight mode. So we're hardwired to treat everything as a threat, everything as a crisis. And when we do that, our body reacts in the normal way it would, right? It releases the stress hormone cortisol. It prepares our body to fight this threat. And that's all fine. But with a crisis, you have to go back to baseline once that crisis is gone. And it's going back to the baseline that is a healthy way of dealing with stress. But workaholics don't ever go back to baseline. And so we're constantly in this fight or flight mode. And so over time, this dysregulation that persists over time, that is what negatively affects many, many downstream health outcomes.
That was an aha moment for me, not returning to baseline. You know, that was the kick in the head to say, okay, that makes sense. I totally relate to the fight or flight, but when it's perpetual, goodness, that is just not, that's not healthy. So I'd love to have you really be clear about workaholic tendencies that we might have as individuals, but also let's be a scout for others and perhaps help be accountability masters. And you and I were talking earlier about how women are navigating life much differently than men. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not saying it's better or worse, but it's clearly different, especially if they have children or they're taking care of elderly parents and they're also engaging in careers. So what are some of those tendencies that we need to look out for?
Well, speaking first to your comment about, you know, women and our unique struggles, I think this is so important. And I'm really glad you brought it up because we have been talking about this ideal worker prototype, right? The worker that is always devoted to work. And this is what is celebrated in our society. Our ideal worker in our head is still a man. A white man is like the prototype that we see, this image in our head. Conversely, when we think about our society's pervasive expectations of what it is to be a good parent, this devotion to family, our schemas are still skewed towards we think of women in that role. Now, obviously, we've come a long way, but these stereotypes, these schemas that we have are very pervasive. And so what I've experienced personally and what I have researched and what I have talked to people in the interviews, always the theme that I hear from women who struggle with workaholism, have a family, even if they don't have a family, they're also the caregivers for their parents or, you know, they're the caregiver in their family most of the time. They're expected to be, at least. And so they struggle with guilt. I can't tell you how many times, the number of times a woman has said, I feel guilty because I'm not at home taking care of my kids because I am career driven. I don't really hear many men saying that. And in the research, women have experienced more negative health outcomes than men on average. And I think a lot of it is these external pressures that women feel to still be the default parent, still be devoted to family, but also to be the ideal worker at the same time. And they're feeling these internal pressures because, you know, they're feeling this guilt that has been kind of socialized into them. So for these reasons, I think it's extremely important to recognize that for women, if they're trying to be successful in their career, to recognize that these feelings of guilt that they may be feeling are, you know, socially prescribed guilt a lot of the times. So I know we're kind of getting more like abstract, but it's something I feel really passionate about.
I can hear it in your voice, and I'm right there with you. You know, it's interesting too, because some of the things that I've read about, women carry a lot of the emotional labor at work. Mm-hmm. And whether they've got children or a large family or are an individual, they're the chief household officer, right? That, mm-hmm. And that comes with a lot of responsibility and a lot of stress. Yep. So you put workaholism on top of that, and my goodness, right. it's a house of cards waiting to fall.
So, it absolutely is. Yeah, they do the invisible labor at home and the actual labor at work.
Yeah. So let's focus on the positive, because we've identified the issue, and the book is gorgeous and full of great wisdom that is practical and actionable. So perhaps you can close with a nugget of, okay, what now? What next? Besides reading the book, which we'll talk about in just a second, what is step one for the workaholic out there shaking her head saying, oh yeah, this is me. What do I do?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things that we can do. One is just kind of reflecting on what are our patterns and our habits, and do we tend to exhibit these workaholic tendencies, and are there areas in our lives that we can make a conscious effort to detach? Whether it's, you know, for example, I just went on a vacation over New Year's, and for the first time in my adult career, I did not bring my laptop on vacation. It was a huge step in my quote unquote recovery, but it was so hard to do. But so try to think, are there things I can do where I can force myself almost to detach?
Was it liberating, or did you find yourself kind of twitching on the vacation saying, oh my gosh, what's going on with email?
I'm not going to lie. There were a little bit, some nagging feelings about, oh, I hope I'm not missing anything big. But overall, it was so refreshing to come back and actually have physically just detached, because I was not able to check my email. And, you know, I took it off my phone and all that. So it really was liberating. And that's just one of many things. But to me, if I have that temptation close to me, whether it's my laptop or my phone, it's really, really hard for me not to just be like, oh, I'll just do this one thing. And then the one thing turns into two things. And then it just kind of snowballs.
I hear you loud and clearly. I am shaking my head in acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Well, Melissa Clark, I have learned so much from you. I want this global audience to go out there and buy your book. It's called Never Not Working: Why the Always On Culture is Bad for Business and How to Fix It. And of course, it's available on Amazon and all major book retailers. But Melissa, if you would be so kind, how can this global audience follow you after the show?
Yeah, absolutely. So they can go to my website, which is my name, but it's spelled uniquely, M-A-L-I-S-S-A Clark, C-L-A-R-K.com. Or you can follow me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. Melissa, I am truly grateful for your research, your extraordinary writing, and all of the work that you're doing to empower people. I have learned from you, and I'm deeply grateful, and I'm delighted that you could spend time with me on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really, really fun.
You are so welcome. And Your Working Life is now available on all major podcast platforms, and I'd love to hear from you. So leave us a review, and this will help new listeners find us online. And a special shout out to my extraordinary podcast colleagues, Laura Deck, Executive Director of Publicity and Communications, and Claire McInerney, Executive Producer. Thank you for making this show awesome for our global audience. We now have listeners in 34 countries. I'm Caroline Dowd-Higgins. Thanks for listening.